Welcome to the Creative Magic Podcast. I am your host, Lucy H. Pierce, and creativity is at the heart of my life as an author, visual artist, editor, and creativity teacher. I've always been fascinated about the creative process and those who dedicate their lives to it. So join me and my guests, writers, artists, creatrixes, magical women, for profound and practical conversations about what creative magic means to us. I'm joined today by Toko Parr Turner, a Canadian author, teacher, and dream worker who blends the mystical teachings of Sufism with a Jungian approach. Toko Parr founded the Dream School in 2001, through which thousands of students have passed. She is also the author of the award-winning book Belonging, Remembering Ourselves Home, that I had the privilege to proofread. It explores the themes of exile and belonging through the lens of memoir, mythology, and nature. This book has resonated with readers worldwide and has been translated into 10 different languages so far, as well as winning a Gold Nautilus Award. Her work focuses on the relationship between psyche and nature and how we follow our inner wisdom to meet with the social, psychological, and ecological challenges of our time. Welcome, Toko Parr. I'm delighted you are joining me today. We have been kind of moving in similar-ish circles for several years now and kind of like coinciding at different tele summits and coinciding with your book, Belonging, which you approached us to proofread. Thank you. And so it's really lovely to finally get to talk to you in person.
It is. I feel like it's been a long time coming, and I'm such an admirer of your writing and publishing career. So I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. And for me, it's a special treat because I am a total Jungian junkie, but have no formal training in it. I've studied lots of modules on it during my undergraduate degree, but the rest of it is self-taught. So I have kind of erred on the side of several Jungian inspired and working authors here because I just, it's my love. But I'd love to start us off with you introducing your, what you do, the dream work, what it is, and how you came to it.
Well, that is a lot to answer. So I'll try and give you the Coles Notes version. So how I came to dream work was actually, my story is a bit unusual, and I do tell some of my story in my book, Belonging, but essentially I left home at a very young age, and I ended up being placed in the system. And the day that I was placed into the system was ostensibly, looking back on it now, the day when I became an orphan, because even though I had parents who were still at the time living in the world, they stopped being a family to me at that time and then never were a family to me afterwards. So I ended up beginning a very rocky and powerful journey at that young age. I was about 14 going on 15. And I did something instinctively, which was that I started to keep a dream journal. And I think at the time, I was just looking for something to anchor me when I had no caregivers. Even from a much younger age, I used to receive very powerful dreams and have very powerful dream experiences. And so there was already, I would say, an inborn sense of being guided from within. And so I started to keep this dream journal, and that I really just kept up the habit. And I would say it would be many years before I was able to decipher The Language of Dreams. And it really wasn't until I was about 19 when I discovered the work of Carl Jung. And I found or took out of the library a famous gateway book called Man and His Symbols, Man and His Symbols, which is a Jungian book. There is some writing by Carl Jung himself, and then also some of his colleagues at the time writing on various subjects. And it's a great introduction.
Actually in Crow Moon. I've referenced it lots of times. So that's really interesting. That was your gateway book.
It was, and it is for so many people because it's readable, it's digestible in essay format, and it contains some really potent ideas in it. And when I read that book, it was like discovering my people. I knew that somehow, internally, spiritually, intellectually, and symbolically, that this was a language I was most comfortable with over any other form of communication in the world. And so that opened up a huge lifelong journey for me into the Jungian world, and but specifically into the practice of dream work. And of course, I started with my own dreams, and I saw Jungian analysts over the years, off and on, pretty much consistently. And then in my late 20s, I became really passionate about sharing what I had learned with the world. And so I started to speak in public places, and it kind of just grew from there. Like you, I am not professionally trained, but as an autodidact, I really consumed a great amount of Jungian material, and then I started to volunteer for the Ontario Jungian Foundation. And that was, I sort of had an internship there. So I got to meet some of the great Jungians passing through those doors and took a lot of the workshops and courses that were offered there. But I will also say, because I was raised as a Sufi in the Sufi tradition and come from this kind of mystical and mystical branch of Islam background. If you know the poetry of Rumi, then you understand a little bit about Sufism, as I know you do, Lucy, by just sharing that for your listeners as well. That for me, the Jungian stuff also, and so I should say psychology in general, had some limitations for me that I would come up against. And so I think the way that I work in present time with dreams is some sort of combination of this mystical approach to working with dreams, where I really believe that we are in conversation with a greater organizing intelligence that is coming through each of us in this sort of naturing through us in the form of these symbols and images. But I also do rely on a great deal of the frameworks provided by analytical psychology to help language and organize our understanding and structure of the psyche.
Because in the Western world, Jungian language is really the only language we have to speak of the deep psyche, of the unconscious, of these strange images and archetypes that come through us. We do not have a native language that we are proficient in within Western patriarchal ideas. So like it is, I think that's why it is such a homecoming to so many of us to discover this language and this work, which is both rigorous and scientific and, you know, appeals to our Western mind, rational mind way of thinking, but it's also deeply rooted in the arts and the ancient things that are coming through us that have come through all humans in the form of art, religion, movement, all of these different things that come through generation after generation after generation of humans, and that we can all somehow find a way back into.
That's such a beautiful observation. I totally agree. I think You know, if you look, I've been over the years studying a lot of indigenous dreaming traditions, and of which there are, you know, countless numbers of dreaming traditions. And we in the West are really alone in dismissing our dreams. And it's so incredibly sad that I've really had to devote my life to trying to be part of the crowd that is championing the importance, the central importance of remembering our dreams, sharing our dreams within community, and trying to relearn that lost or forgotten language, which is really our mother tongue. It transcends race, it transcends culture, it transcends era, it transcends ideology. Everywhere in the world, we have people who who are dreaming symbols that are similar to one another. It's an amazing phenomenon to find these what Jung called the archetypes, which are these blueprints for certain patterns that exist within the psyche that transcend all of those normal limitations that we imagine we have between borders and even eras. So I really think that dreams are central, and we can take a great deal of guidance from Indigenous cultures because we can see how dreams are shared within those cultures as a matter of course, that from those dreams are derived all sorts of historical knowledge, knowledge about the wisdom of nature, knowledge about even time outside of the present. So, you know, because many people report being able to have precognitive dreams and prophetic dreams throughout all of the traditions and all of history, we find these examples of prophetic and precognitive dreams. And so there's a huge amount of information that's coming through our dreams that really is just being dismissed. And I think it's a huge reason why we are at such a dangerous cultural and ecological precipice right now, because we are not in contact with that greater intelligence that is naturing through us.
Oh, so beautifully put. Thank you. So I had a question, but I want to park that for the question about these precognitive dreams that you're talking about. In the book, I talk about what I call dark gifts, which are, for example, precognition or different kind of psychic abilities, things that our culture doesn't have a framework for and yet have shown up in humans. Kind of supernatural gifts that people can have that have shown up in humans throughout cultures, throughout times, and in many cultures are just accepted parts of being human, but in our culture are very much shied away from the people, especially women, because it does tend to be women tend to have more of these dark gifts, tend to be very shamed for it. And we often, if we so for example, this precognition thing, I experienced a lot of that during my teenage years and early 20s, and it really freaked me out, like knowing that somebody was about to die. When somebody started talking to me, I was like, oh, they're going to tell me that so-and-so is dead. There was no reason why. I didn't know the person was ill. It was just like, they're dead, that's what I'm going to be told. Or, the plane's going to crash this evening, I'm not going to be on it, I'm going to be on the next one, so I'm fine. That sort of thing, which really freaked me out. And it seemed related to my art making process, my image making process. So I shut both of those down because they really, really freaked me out. And so the process of creating Crow Moon was a process of engaging with those dark gifts again and the image making process and letting the image making process emerge from me and guide me with symbols in the way that it did in my teens when it emerged the first time. And so I just wonder. And obviously, you are not the oracle of the universe, but do you have any idea yourself where what these gifts are, like what they're dealing with, how they work? Do you have a sense of what they are, how they function in us?
Well, I mean, I have a theory, and it has to do with the imaginal capacity. And so in the same in the Sufi tradition, the imaginal dimension, which is to say that place from which dreams emerge, the place to which ancestors return, or at least pass through to return to somewhere beyond that. In the Sufi tradition, this imaginal realm is called Alam al-Mithal. And it was Henri Corbin, a French theologian who specialized in mystical Islamic texts, and one of the great Islamic theologians, I think, of the 20th century, came up with an English or Latin word, mundus imaginalis, to describe the Sufi concept of the imaginal world. So that's the translation, mundus imaginalis, imaginal world or imaginal realm. But the reason why he differentiated it from the words imaginary or illusory is because we in the West tend to use these words in a derogatory sense. We think of them as something that's less real or made up or less valuable than this physical material world. But the Sufis believe that the imaginal world is as ontologically real as the world of our senses. And in fact, the two are so deeply entwined that they're inseparable. Nothing that exists that we have created, say, as human species in the physical world, didn't first take its roots in the imagination. It had to be imagined or dreamed first before it could be created in physicality. And so coming back to your question, this very real world of the imaginal is a place where we artists, shamans, people who have what you call dark gifts can go to perceive and pull out the patterns from the universal cosmos. So what I mean by that is, when we are dreaming spontaneously, we think that our dreams are kind of this random, many people, I w not all of us, but many people believe that it's just a bunch of random nonsense. And the dreams, especially if they have images that are replicating yesterday's events, or because they had too much cheese before bed, or whatever, people tend to dismiss their dreams because they think it's just a, random firing of neurons that has nothing to do with any kind of meaning. But in my experience, having worked with thousands of dreams, I have never met a dream that didn't yield very important insight for the dreamer. There are no throwaway dreams. That doesn't mean you have to pay attention to all your dreams, because then you would have a full-time job like me. But actually, when you do pay attention to your dreams, there can be important in organizing information, which is putting you, your life path, your attitude, your location in the family of things into a specific kind of alignment. Or I don't love the word alignment, but let's say resonance is a better word, resonance with the who that you are meant to become. So I know I'm tackling a lot here, and you can pull on any of those threads, But I don't know if I've even managed to answer your question, but it's like one of those, it's sort of a Pandora's box of ideas, right? Like what, why do we have precognitive dreams or thoughts or intuitions? I think because, well, time doesn't really exist in the way that we perceive it in a linear sense. And when we can partake or when we have an openness to the imaginal realm, we can perceive those patterns that exist already in some future overlapping place with the present. So a very awkward response to a great question, but feel free to pull on any of those threads. I'll see if I can do any better.
Incredible response. I'm curious if you have, I mean, obviously, dark gifts is my word, whatever term kind of feels right to you, but if you ever have had an experience of things emerging, gifts, talents, ways of being emerging within you that haven't felt safe and that you've felt that you've had to shut down.
I didn't have the experience you describe of feeling afraid of those things. And I wonder if it has to do with the story I was telling earlier about how much I needed guidance and how much I needed a sense that something, someone was looking after me. And so at a very young age, I trusted those things. Even began to experiment with, and I don't do this anymore unless I error, but I would experiment with saying things out loud to people. So I would perceive things, right? Like I remember this one time I was at an event and a bunch of us were gathered at a table and a woman came over and I said, "Oh, you must be Katya." And she looked totally shocked. We were strangers. I'd never met her, but I heard it. And I have this kind of like, it's more like an auditory thing, like things are spoken to me. And her name was spoken to me. And I know that I shouldn't know those things. And so I would sometimes play with them and I would say, "So you're Katya." And she was, she looked very upset with me because how the heck would I know this about her? And she was like, "I don't even tell anybody that that's my real name. I tell everybody my name is Katie because I just don't want to cause confusion," or I forget what her reason was for saying that. But I delight in these moments because, it's like whatever you want to call it, God, the intelligence of nature, the organizing principle, the holy in matter, whatever it is a true thing. And I think the more open we are to practicing it, the more comfortable we can become. But it does freak people out for sure. And so I try to be careful, more careful with that. But of course, it comes in handy when helping other people with their dreams too, because I can often hear what's not being said.
That's really, really interesting.
But maybe I'll just say, I don't know if I'm particularly unique in this way, except for the fact that I have spent my life paying attention to this stuff. That I think this is a capacity of all humans. I don't think that I'm some, like you said, oracle of the universe. I'm one of them. But I think we all can be, if we have those receptors open.
I think so too, but I do think just as some of us are more visual in our ways of learning or thinking or perceiving the world, and some of us rely more on auditory stuff. I think that some of us we have different skill sets. Some things are more natural or easy to us, and some things are trickier and kind of we would have to learn and really focus on more. But I completely agree that I don't think that they are unusual, and I think that's what is so tragic about our culture now is that we are coming off the back of hundreds upon hundreds of years of people being taught to shut down these skills, these very human capacities, and to feel scared when they emerge and just shut them down. And so we are being less human. We've got less skills, fewer skills than we should have at our fingertips because we're taught to distrust them.
I think for me, just sort of reflecting on what you're saying, I don't think it ever made me afraid, but because it makes other people afraid, I think it can be alienating. I still have that experience in present time that there are very few people who I can hang with in that way, because most people just prefer to stay on the surface. And I spend so much time in the depths that I'm socially awkward in that way. Let's put it that way.
Me too. Me too. I would much prefer to be following the symbols and the images and diving deep rather than having kind of small talk conversation over dinner with people who bore me.
Yes. Hallelujah.
So I'd love you to share a little bit more about when you are working with people, and for example, there's a symbol that's coming up for them again and again in their lives, in their dreams, that feels really strong. Is there a kind of a way or two that you love to work with that and that you might be able to share here? Because I know a lot of people can kind of feel almost haunted by certain symbols and images that emerge in their unconscious, but they don't know what to do with them. They don't know kind of what the next step is.
Yeah, you know, the method that I use for dream work is something that I call courtship. And I use this old timey word because I think it's quite charming, this idea that, you know, in the olden days, you would, if you found a partner you were interested in, you would make a courtship of them. And that was sort of a process of circling them from a distance, a respectful distance, and trying to learn what they love, what they need, what they long for, and then to make every effort to provide them with that in the hopes that you might become closer and closer, ultimately and eventually, after some slow, elongated choreography, you might even marry in a kind of union. And so for me, this is such a beautiful metaphor for working with our dream symbols, because, you know, it means undoing a very rationalistic approach to dreams, which, if anybody pays attention to dreams, it's usually in this way. They buy a dream dictionary or they look it up on the internet and they just want to know what is the definition of this symbol. And I call this the acquisitional approach to dream work. It's like, just give me the bottom line. Just tell me what it means for me so that I can get something out of it, or, you know, be relieved of whatever anxiety or haunting, as you called it, it's causing me. And so the way that I work with dreams is this slow circling process. And it's something anybody can learn, but it requires a kind of patience and a willingness to be in the discomfort of not knowing whether you're going to get to that bottom line. And it is that not knowing which is the precondition for revelation. And it's a kind of initiatory substance, that not knowing, when it comes to dream work. And so let's say you have a symbol that comes up in your dream. I just want everyone to know that you have everything contained within you that you need to understand what that symbol has to say to you, what that symbol is about. It's just a matter of excavating what you know, what resonates for you deep in your bones. And how do you do that? Really through a process of asking yourself questions. The first thing you could do is describe, first of all, write down your dream. That's number one. You have to do that. There's no getting out of it. So if you think that you could just voice record it, you know, you could start there, but then you have to write it down because you need to see the words. You need to be able to refer back to it. And take your time writing down your dream. Write it in present tense always. The reason is it will bring you back into the present moment of being inside the dream and allow more embodied details to emerge. And then, you know, if you have that one haunting symbol, try not to occlude the rest of the dream, because it's often in the other details where the wisdom of the dream will lie. So make sure to sort of widen your scope to look at the other aspects of the dream as well. What gave rise to the thing happening? What moment gave birth to the next moment, which gave birth to the thing that is haunting you? And then you can ask yourself, have I given a robust enough description of that thing? Let's say, for instance, it's a character. Let's say you have a character who is an intruder that comes into your house. What do they look like? Can you tell their gender? What vibe are they giving off? Do you recognize them? Do they remind you of anyone? What are they wearing? What seems familiar about them? Does that energy that you get from them remind you of anything in waking life? So you really have to kind of get into these details. And I try to teach people how to ask artful questions to get at a dreams meeting. And I sort of lead you through a process of making this courtship. And to finally, ultimately make the connection between what is happening for you in waking life, whether that's an event on the outside or a relationship on the outside, or whether it's an internal process, an internal relationship, and trying to make the connection between the symbols, the metaphors that are occurring in your dream and the similarities that are happening in your waking life. And that's the true magic, is finding the metaphor. And once you can do that, everything starts to fall into place.
Well, I find that totally myself, because most of my books start with a metaphor. They start with me realizing that I'm using words, images, metaphors around a certain topic, and that is just so alive for me. And then I'm hearing other people using them, and I'm needing to be able to unpack the meaning behind that metaphor and to dive deeper and deeper into it. So that's really interesting that you said that. So this series is called Wild Initiations. And you mentioned dreams as initiatory there. And I'd love to just touch on that for a moment with you. So I considered this book to be an initiation of both earth and air. And illness as well, because illness was an initiatory thing in my book Medicine Woman, but in this, migraines became just the all-encompassing world that I lived in. I was living in a dark room for week after week with constant migraines, very, very visual images pouring through me, and my pupils hugely dilated. So this is the world that the book takes place in, as I follow this hooded figure that's guiding me deeper and deeper into the dark forest that initially really terrifies me, but I learn to trust this figure that keeps emerging through these images. And so I just wondered if, because as a culture, we don't have initiations as part of our framework of culture. We do birthdays, we do weddings, but really apart from that, we don't have initiations into new stages of psychological development. And so I was just really curious if you've had any experiences of either elemental initiations or initiations of illness that really feel like they've been kind of moments in your life that before you were one thing and after you were another, and really making your passage through that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I speak about that in Belonging, as you probably remember. And yeah, it's tricky with illnesses because they often don't have set beginnings and endings, you know. So when we think of initiations in stories, or we imagine initiations in cultures that provide for those transition times as being, you know, short, concise, and delineated, whereas illness is not at all compact and neat. like that.
There
so
is
all
before and after. There is often a kind of a when I was well, and then when things got really intense, or when things were at a specific, you know,
yeah,
you're trying to
yeah.
get where you can't because you won't.
Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say is you don't always get better, and also that it can be really, really long. Like I know for some people who have been in illness for almost a decade. In fact, that's my story. And so I was diagnosed with an autoimmune disease called rheumatoid arthritis in 2016. It took many years to get that diagnosis. It took many years to treat that diagnosis. And now I'm living with the disabilities that illness has caused in my body. Also, autoimmune diseases tend to cluster. So there's a few of them in there. So I don't know that I'm in an after kind of period, but I do see how being initiated by illness has stripped a great deal from my life. Learning to live with disability is, wow, it's an ongoing process every single day. So I'm not, I guess what I'm saying is I'm not sure that I have the hindsight yet because I'm still in it. And that would be like, you know, 8 years into the process. And so I'm not exactly sure if I got what the question was. Have I had those experiences? Yes. Am I finished? Is there a before and after? There's a before. I suppose I'm in an after. Well, I don't want to, you know, depress everybody, but it's, you know, it's not the happy, bright, you know, golden, triumphant place that we imagine in storybooks.
To me, what I would consider my initiations has broken me further, broken me open, slowed me down, helped me have insights into things I didn't, but there's been no kind of hooray, finished. But there is very much a before and after, as in before this happened, I didn't see the world or myself in this sort of way, and now I
yeah.
do.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, I've probably had a large number of those sorts of initiations. Leaving home was certainly a very, very big one. And then stepping into my vocation with DreamWork and as an author, those certainly were big thresholds for me. And then definitely illness, for sure.
Yeah, books tend to be a big one. I often warn our authors that, because people don't often see that coming. It's like, yay, I finished the book. It's going to be out in the world. Hooray. And it's like, whoa, there's a big portal to walk through here between having your work unknown and unseen and having it out there in the world. It's a massive one.
Yeah. And you have, I mean, you're just sort of amazingly prolific and you have done it many, many times. So do you find that you're seasoned to the process now?
Well, each book is a new journey. So each one is confronting something that is terrifying within me. So each one is an overcoming. Each one is, I mean, the worst one was Burning Woman. Burning Woman was a big one, which I really didn't think I was going to actually live to see the launch. It was that intense. Chrome Moon is very daunting because it's walking into new territory. It's bringing the word and image process that I've been working with privately and teaching for several years into book form, and that thing of going between words and images backwards and forwards, rather than just illustrating a book. Actually, the images are part of the process, part of the journey. And then the words are actually the supporting thing sometimes. So that is that's the big one for this. So I guess the more important a book, the deeper a book is for me, the harder it is to put it out into the world, because it feels so vulnerable. It feels so tender and scary, and you don't know how it will be received.
I keep thinking of Hildegard von Bingen when you tell your story, because she used to have those terrible migraines. They were accompanied by visions, and her great musical compositions came out of that illness.
I have that. I want to write a book about migraine and creativity, whether there's enough material that I can get my hands on out there beyond my own experiences. Hildegard is one of the people I have bookmarked, but I find it fascinating because there is a something there. You know, it's a kind of the portal opening in our consciousness is accompanied by pain and suffering as well as this visioning things. So I'm really curious about it. So
And people will argue that point too sometimes. I've said similar things to what you just said, and people will argue and say, well, not all creativity has to come out of suffering. And I think that's true. Not all creativity does have to come out of suffering. But it does seem that the really meaningful stuff, for me anyway, comes out of a great deal of suffering.
It seems as though there is a cost or a price to it.
It
And
does, yeah.
maybe just what we have been resisting. And so it costs us in the tense muscles that we're getting through and the psychological resistance. I don't know, but like there is, you know, I can do fun creativity that doesn't cost me anything and is wonderful and it fills me up and it's joyous. But the deep work has a price, but one that I'm willing to pay for where it takes me. So you're working on your second book at the moment. Are you able to tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I'm more like every 5 to 7 years I can write a book. Yes. So this book is all about dreams, and it's maybe what should have been my first book, or what people may have expected my first book to be, though there is quite a lot of dream work and belonging. But this is more specifically about my conceptual world around dreams, and also the practical tools for working with your own dreams. It's a mix of philosophy and practical and storytelling.
So when are you hoping for it to be out? And do you have a title that you can share with us yet?
You know, it's too soon for me to share the title, but the aim is to put it out in October. October the 16th is the date we have right now, but I have also delayed the publication date multiple times, so I wouldn't hang any promises on that date.
Hopefully before Christmas.
Yeah, I think that's the plan. It is very close.
And how is the process second time round?
I think it's been even harder. And that just might be because, I mean, the first book was hard because the hardest parts for me were the memoirs, because as you described, I had to go into some very deep places to excavate wisdom from very difficult times in my life. To be able to share my story in a way that would be compassionate and also supportive and engaging for another person. I knew that I needed to find that compassion for myself in order to communicate compassion for the reader. So those were the hardest parts. This book is not about me at all, but it is in the sense that I'm trying to collate my entire life's work into a book. You know, I've been practicing dream work professionally for a couple of decades. And so just really wanting to say everything and say it in a way that it's not too complicated and heady, and wanting it to be accessible and juicy. And there's so much I want to say. So at the moment, it's 100,000 words, which is many, many, many words. And so we'll see how many end up in the final copy. There may be more than one book in there. I don't know.
And that's just writer to writer and editor to writer. That is the skill is in making two smaller books rather than one that's too overwhelming for you or for the reader is finding where you've started moving into other territory, so that it, because it doesn't all have to be in one book.
Yeah.
So tell us, Tokopa, where can people find you? Where do you like to engage with the world? Because some of us love one social media and hate another. And so where can they find you?
Yeah, well, I, to be honest, have withdrawn from the world of social media for the better part, well, since the pandemic. So I used to post there a lot and share a lot of quotes from my work, and I've just really stopped doing that so I can focus on the writing. So once I am able to emerge on the other side of this project, I'm sure I'll be sharing more. And the two places I do that the most are on Instagram and Facebook. So, you know, I have one of those names that's really easy to find, Tokopa. So you just, you know, pop it into the Google and you'll find me. I'm Tokopa without a dash on Instagram, T-O-K-O-P-A. And something similar will get you to find me on Facebook as well. But you can also go to my website, tokopa.com.
Beautiful website. I had website envy when I was on there getting your bio.
Oh, that's nice to hear.
So I do encourage people to go and check out your work, because it is profound and healing and very, very wise. So thank you, Tokopa, for giving me your time and your energy today.
What a joy it was. I had been looking forward to the conversation, and my goodness, it didn't disappoint. So I really hope you've enjoyed that too. Please do let me know on Instagram at Creative Magic Podcast or at Lucy H. Pierce what you loved about this episode, what your takeaways are. Please be sure to follow the podcast, give us a 5-star rating, tell all your friends about us, and come back again next time for more creative magic.